Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The NRA's response to Sandy Hook, armed guards at all schools. We do the math. The serious mistakes that surgeons make, including the wrong surgery, and why those brainiac toys for kids are a waste of money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ryssdal, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, December 21st. Thanks for being here. The National Rifle Association said earlier this week it would make a meaningful contribution to the effort to reduce gun violence in the wake of the Sandy Hook tragedy. Today, the NRA made it clear that contribution would not be major compromise on gun laws. Instead, the group called for tougher measures against criminals, a crackdown on video game violence, and armed guards in every school in the country. NRA Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
So we wondered, how would a plan for armed security at every school work? And how much would it cost? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
The NRA is calling on Congress to appropriate whatever is necessary to put armed police officers in every school in the country. So what would be necessary? A lot of money. Mo Kennedy is head of the National Association of School Resource Officers. He says it would cost $80,000 per year for one armed school guard, counting salary, benefits, and equipment.
The training of this person, making sure they're properly equipped. You know, a lot of departments certainly provide patrol cars.
So if you wanted to put a trained armed officer in every school in the country, you'd have to plunk down almost $8 billion. Per year. The NRA says if there's not enough money for that, it can provide armed volunteers for schools. But volunteers also come with a cost, according to gun control expert Robert Spitzer at the State University of New York at Cortland. He says schools would need more liability insurance.
The insurance issue is a significant question, especially when it's somebody who might be a volunteer or somebody who had training once, and perhaps that training therefore wouldn't have lapsed.
Some school security officials say guns are the least cost-effective option. Larry Johnson is head of security for the Grand Rapids, Michigan School District. He could have armed the district's guards, but decided not to. He says counseling is more effective.
I think in the end, counseling is cheaper, and I think counseling is going to go much longer. It's going to get a bigger bang for our buck here.
And Johnson says counseling helps troubled kids become stable adults, so they're less likely to go on a shooting spree after they get out of school. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
So you probably know by now that the country needs a backup plan. To the backup plan. President Obama just spoke, saying Congress was going to take a break, but he was ready to move forward with a plan on the fiscal cliff before January 1st. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Shireen Marisol Meraji reports on what will happen to poor Americans if that doesn't happen.
If you've been out of work for a while, you're the tip of the spear.
So the biggest impact on the first day will really be for workers who are out of work and collecting unemployment benefits.
Sharon Parrott is a VP at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
2 million workers at the end of December would lose access to those extended benefits.
For everyone else, it's more gradual.
Elizabeth Lauerbach is a senior analyst at CLASP, a nonprofit that promotes policies for low-income Americans. She says spending will be cut by 8% on government programs that help the poor, job training programs, Head Start for preschoolers, and federal housing assistance.
But again, it won't be sort of all of a sudden that agencies are holding off on putting out contracts and spending money.
Another way the fiscal cliff could hurt poor families, says Parrott, is when certain tax credits aren't extended.
A mother working full-time at the minimum wage, raising two children, could lose almost all of her $1,700 child tax credit.
But she adds that won't happen until later, when 2013 taxes are due.
The biggest danger to low-income Americans, if we fall off the fiscal cliff, is the risk of recession.
Economist Nick Eberstadt wrote A Nation of Takers, America's Entitlement Epidemic. Eberstadt says cuts to programs that help the poor will have a minor impact compared to the rise in unemployment if Congress can't fix this. All three experts agree that the real hurt from a tumble off the fiscal cliff will come long after January 1st. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Christmas cheer, well, it disappeared, on Wall Street anyway. Details when we do the numbers. Joining us now to talk more about the disarray in Washington and what somebody on Twitter called the coming Cliffmas season are John Carney of CNBC and Lee Gallagher of Fortune. Hi, guys.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hey, let's start with some audio from President Obama, who just spoke from the White House about this impasse. Let's listen to what he said.
I expect Democrats and Republicans to get back to Washington and have it pass both chambers. And I will immediately sign that legislation into law before January 1st of next year. It's that simple.
Lee, what do you think? Is it that simple?
Well, if it were that simple, I think we'd have a deal already. But, you know, look, he's coming out. He's saying more of the same.
Yeah.
But, you know, applying a little Christmas pressure. You know, everybody go home, have some eggnog, cool off, sing some Christmas carols, and we get back. You know, he's, you know, the implication is he's not going to soften. I mean, this has got to get done. I also thought that was interesting. He said, you know, this is – nobody gets 100%, which is, again, something we've been saying. But you know, this isn't a contest about who looks good. So that was sort of a dig.
John, did you hear anything new in what he said?
No, nothing at all. I think when they do come back from their Christmas breaks, they're going to have exactly the same impasse. And Obama called himself a hopeless optimist, which is a little bit of a contradiction in terms.
Yeah.
But I think he's way too optimistic about the possibility of getting something done before January 1st.
Yeah. Lee, talk about how the markets reacted today to this impasse. What happened?
Not well. I mean, the markets kind of fell apart today, which is interesting because up until very recently, the markets really were assuming a deal would be done. And that was just sort of baked into the numbers. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. So I think there's a general panic that's starting to heat up everywhere with consumers, too. And you can see why. I mean, here we are 9 days away.
Yeah. John, what do you expect to happen on the stock market if we don't get a deal? Bye.
I think there will be a major sell-off, and actually there's a big potential for this to happen next week because volumes will be very low, and so a little bit of selling pressure can make the market take the market down very rapidly. A lot of people won't be paying attention until they wake up in the morning and they hear, hey, the market just sold off, 2, 3, 4% in one day. That's going to be a big deal.
Yeah. Lee, there are people who are talking on television about, analysts saying if we go off this fiscal cliff, this could put us into recession again. What do you think?
I think there is a possibility of that. I mean, I think if we go off the cliff, it will be very temporary because nobody wants to vacuum out whatever hundreds or trillions of dollars from the economy. We're just too vulnerable, and I think everybody knows that. But, I think there'll be a big impact in the stock market. If you remember what happened when we were downgraded because of the debt ceiling debate last year, it was a really terrible day. And I think that'll happen again because it's just not good.
Yeah. John, you agree?
Wall Street doesn't like to see what looks like dysfunction in government. And investors across America, get wary about earnings when the government is talking about raising taxes tremendously as well as cutting spending when the economy is already a little bit weak. It has the potential to push us into a recession. I agree with Lee that we will end up reducing some of the tax hikes, restoring some of the spending, probably enough to keep us from actually entering a recession in 2013.
Yeah. In 10 seconds or less, guys, are your friends talking about this or are we just in the media and, on Capitol Hill and in New York?
I had the first conversation in a bar this week about the fiscal cliff. Somebody
really?
I knew someone whose job was placed on hold. It was a government job because of the fiscal cliff. So I do think it's starting to seep into consumer consciousness.
Yeah.
I definitely think people are paying attention and they understand that this is coming. I think a lot of people had assumed, I'm just going to ignore it because this is all just, you know, politics as usual, and eventually a deal will come out of it. As we're getting closer and closer to January 1st, people are starting to realize, nope. There really isn't a deal. This wasn't just a fake fight. This was a real fight. And these people are very far away from each other in terms of policy. And so it is seeping into people's minds.
John Carney of CNBC, Lee Gallagher of Fortune. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you're doing some last-minute holiday shopping for the latest high-tech gadgets, ask yourself this question. How many of the products that you and your family covet have a Japanese brand on them? That tablet, that TV, is it made by Sony? What about Panasonic or Sharp? It wasn't that long ago that Japanese electronics were on top of the world. So what happened? Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff went looking for answers.
If you want to see just how bad things have gotten for Japanese electronics, head to the Sony store in Midtown Manhattan. There appear to be more staff than customers. And outside, people like Christy Visa show how much things have changed.
My phone's Apple and my computer's Samsung.
Then I found Troy Allen waiting outside Sony's window.
One hand you have an iPhone, the other hand you have an iPad mini, and you're standing outside the Sony store.
Oh yeah, because my friend works for Sony.
Ouch, and it's not just Sony. This year, Panasonic expects to lose $10 billion with a B. The market value of Sony, Panasonic, and Sharp combined is a fraction of Apple's. Their debt is considered junk. Gerhard Fassel heads consulting firm Eurotechnology in Tokyo.
At least one of these companies might go bankrupt.
It's easy to find places where each company went wrong. Sony lost out to the iPod. Panasonic made too many products. Sharp's Japanese-made TVs were too expensive. But how do you explain an entire sector in an entire country in decline?
Japan is sleepwalking to oblivion.
Michael Woodford was an executive at Japanese camera maker Olympus. He says the country's electronics companies have few new ideas because their aging management doesn't promote creativity.
Because you need people to be a bit crazy, to be a bit wacky. But the nail which sticks up in Japan, they say, will get nailed down.
In a business environment that favors big companies, there are few startups to keep the Sonys and Panasonics on their toes. Richard Katz is the editor of the Oriental Economist Report.
Japan does not have that natural selection process as part of its business culture.
Katz says the Japanese government is reluctant to let companies fail.
So they constantly try to merge, you know, three sick companies into one larger company, which in fact is even sicker.
The government is currently propping up one of the country's big chip makers. Sharp may be the next firm seeking a bailout. Michael Zelenziger of Oxford Economics says Japanese culture made the companies less nimble.
The Japanese social code makes it very difficult to fire workers if they're redundant.
And Japan's companies have missed some big opportunities by focusing on the market at home. Nowhere is that more obvious than in cell phones. Ride the Tokyo subway or walk around a city, and it's like a time warp. Many from teen girls to salarymen are using flip phones. Years ago, these were state of the art.
The Japanese were far ahead of the Americans from the consumer standpoint in their ability of phones to send text messages, to download videos.
But even though Japan had those technologies before the West, Zelenziger says it didn't export them. And as phones went smart, TVs went flat, and music went digital, Samsung and Apple swept in.
They've really stolen a march on most of the innovative technology that we once thought the Japanese had a real advantage with.
It's not all doom and gloom. Canon and Nikon still lead in higher-end cameras. But increasingly, some of Japan's most storied brands are being reduced to making parts. Sony, for one, supplies the iPhone's camera. But that's not where the big money is. And back outside the Sony store in Manhattan, I did find Richard DeWeese, a passerby who'd bought a Japanese TV recently. Though, not a Sony.
It was a Panasonic HD flat screen.
Why'd you choose Panasonic?
Because Apple didn't make one.
And not to pile on here, but Sony's put its fancy New York headquarters up for sale. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Still shopping for electronics, Japanese or otherwise? If you want to know the best time to buy that gift, go to marketplace.org for our holiday shopping price tracker. Coming up,
parents are nervous that if they aren't buying these high-quality, educational, expensive toys, their children are going to be somehow disadvantaged.
But is that true? Putting educational toys to the test. But first, let's do the numbers. After some big dips during the day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 0.9%, or 120 points, to end at 13,190. The NASDAQ slid 0.9%, or 29 points, to close at 3021. And the S&P 500 also dropped 0.9%, that's 13 points, to finish at 1430. For the week, and it was a good one after all, the Dow added 0.4%, the NASDAQ picked up 1.7%, and the S&P 500 gained 1.2%. Financial stocks were feeling the fiscal pain. Bank of America unbanked 2%. Citigroup reversed 1.2%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday, the night before Christmas. The stock market closes early for Christmas Eve. Great excuse to finish your holiday shopping. I mean, that is the last day to do it. The final, final, drop-dead date to wrap it up. Hey, I'm on it. And for your safety, the North American Aerospace Defense Command tracks Santa. NORAD says Santa has been flying for centuries without hitting anything. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner, in for Kai Ristall. Facebook says it's testing a new service in the U.S. A random selection of users will be able to send messages to you, even if you aren't Facebook friends with them. Instead of that message going into the other folder, it will land directly in your inbox, and it will cost the sender a dollar. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story on Facebook's latest effort to make money off all its friends. I mean, customers.
When I first heard that you could pay to send a message to a stranger through Facebook, I called Clark Fredrickson at eMarketers to ask him if this new experiment was essentially allowing users to pay a fee to spam you. Facebook wasn't able to answer that question.
Ooh, controversial question. I think that's unclear at this point.
Fredrickson says that Facebook has traditionally put its users first, but now that Facebook is public, there's mounting pressure for it to make money.
And that's why we're seeing them explore other avenues to revenue.
Let's take a brief stroll down some of those avenues. There's the Facebook payment program that allows you to send money through Facebook. There were the new rules that allowed Facebook to sell your Instagram photos without telling you, which has been shelved. And there is what are called sponsored wall posts. You may have noticed ads appearing on your wall, not next to it where there have always been ads, but directly in your newsfeed, like the one I got today from my friend Casey. So I called her up.
So I just got the post that you put on Facebook saying that it would bring me some holiday cheer that there's a 50% sale at Target.
And you got that post from me?
Yeah. Did you post that?
No, absolutely not.
It turns out a while back, Casey liked Target on Facebook, which means that Target, for a price, can now post ads using her name, so it appears that she's posting them. Casey's reaction when I told her... That sentiment could put advertisers in a difficult position. It could also put Facebook in a difficult position if users once again object to its efforts to monetize them. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
If you have surgery scheduled in the near future, you will want to hear this. Or perhaps not. There's new research that shows surgeons make thousands of errors every year. More than 4,000, in fact. They're called never events, as in they should never happen in the operating room. Dr. Peter Pronovost is co-author of the new study. He's VP for Patient Safety at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Dr. Pronovost, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's great to be here.
When we say that these are serious medical errors, what exactly does that mean? Describe some of these.
About 40 patients a week have surgery in which a sponge is left in or a towel is left in, And about 20 patients per week have surgery on the wrong side of their body
wow.
or the wrong part of their body. And another 20 per week have the wrong operation.
Wow.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And these 20 per week across the country, the public scratches their head and say, come on, you got to be kidding me about this.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not a surgeon, so explain to me how this could happen, leaving a sponge inside a patient. How's that happen?
These are very complex operations. And, you know, for example, right now we'll do operations where we'll use sponges and maybe scores of them, sometimes up to 100. And then the way we keep track of whether we left them in you is simply counting what went in and counting when they came out. And as you can imagine, that's a fairly crude way of measuring if we forgot to left something in.
Doctor, how much of this is simply surgeons being overworked, overtired?
Well, fatigue and overwork have chronically been a problem. But what's more concerning now is the risk that health reform is going to make it worse. And what we're seeing across the country is hospital administrators are saying, doctor, you have to work longer hours because we don't have the money to support it. And so workload has gone up dramatically.
Do we know, did we have these sorts of surgical errors before that law came into being too?
Oh, yeah. These have been going on since we've been practicing medicine. I by no means wanted to imply that the healthcare law is causing these. But what healthcare hasn't done is use technology to improve productivity. It's largely relied on the heroism of doctors and nurses to keep things safe. And now we're asking even greater heroism of this. And we really have to start saying, hey, it's time for technology to lead the way.
Dr. Peter Pronovost is Senior VP for Patient Safety at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And The Good Doctor has more on what you can do as a patient to prevent surgical mistakes. Just go to marketplace.org. If you're one of those parents who fears spoiling the kids with too many holiday gifts, well, the marketplace has a solution. They're called educational toys. You can find all kinds of pricey toys and videos claiming to stimulate brain development. But do they work? And if so, does that leave poor kids at a disadvantage if their families can't afford them? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler looked into it.
Every year, parents spend lots of money on DVDs that purport to help kids develop bigger brains. Baby Einstein is among the most popular videos. Dr. Dimitri Christakis is with Seattle's Children's Research Institute. While he won't single out any particular product, he does say,
there is no evidence whatsoever that these so-called educational baby DVDs offer any advantage. And the best available evidence actually suggests that there's harm associated with them.
The American Academy of Pediatrics discourages TV and videos for kids under the age of two. In his own research, Christakis has studied infants who watched baby DVDs compared with infants who, instead, played with building blocks. His study found that blocks were better for brain development.
Blocks have never made any educational claims. I don't think that parents have bought blocks specifically to make their child smarter or certainly not to improve their language development. And yet, in that study, we demonstrated that, in fact, they do that.
The key, he says, is parent-child interaction. That's what builds brains. I asked if kids from low-income families are at a disadvantage if they don't have the latest educational toy or DVD. The short answer, no.
Parents are nervous that if they aren't buying these high-quality, educational, expensive toys, their children are going to be somehow disadvantaged. And the reality is that which is simplest is frequently best, that the best educational toys are things like blocks, like books.
Researchers do see differences in brain development between rich and poor kids. Douglas Vanderbilt is a developmental behavioral pediatrician at Children's Hospital Los Angeles.
The real difference is not the baby Einstein or the special toys they get at the special toy shop. It's that higher income families speak more to their child. They have more child-directed language.
Vanderbilt tried using educational videos with his own child.
My daughter, I wanted to learn Chinese. Let me get the Chinese videos. She didn't learn any of the words in the Chinese videos. Actually, the word she learned was the one that she learned with my mother-in-law, who speaks Chinese.
Again, it's that interaction that makes the difference. So, what about interactive computer games and smartphone apps for kids? Though research is limited, some apps for kids show promise for critical thinking and communication. And on this front, there is a digital divide between rich and poor families.
We coined the term the app gap.
Shira Lee Katz is with Common Sense Media, an organization that helps kids and parents navigate the media landscape.
We did a study last year, and we found that among lower-income children, 27% have a parent with a smartphone compared to 57% for higher-income kids.
She says low-income families can bridge that gap by using libraries and after-school programs, where tablets with educational apps are increasingly available for kids. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
So what do you think? Send us your thoughts on whether brainy toys and videos make kids smarter, and if so, which ones? Tweet us at MarketplaceAPM.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, a look at the less serious news that didn't quite make the show this week. It comes courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Galliano with some help from the Marketplace staff.
Gina Delvac, freelance producer at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
In Paris this week, a new exhibit opened. It's called The Museum of Broken Relationships. What better kind of exhibit to have in the city of love, right?
What is in it?
It's where people can bring mementos of failed relationships. It's to share in the collective pain of some past breakup.
Do you think this has anything to do with Gerard Depardieu breaking up with France to avoid taxes?
Oh, definitely. And not to mention it's in the basement of what used to be the municipal funeral home.
Oh, man. Get over it, France. There are other thespians out there.
Ben Johnson, producer, what's your story?
Apple had a patent claim rejected.
They're patented to be one of the wealthiest companies on the planet?
Not exactly. It was a technology for their iPhone. It was the pinch and zoom function that you can use to sort of zoom into a picture.
So this doesn't bode well for their Karate Chop and Tickle application for the iPad.
Yeah, Karate Chop and Tickle is pretty universal.
Chrissy Clark, senior reporter, Wealth and Poverty Desk. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So in Wales, a worker has won a £3,000 settlement for being fired inappropriately at McDonald's. She gave a coworker extra chocolate sprinkles on the McFlurry that she'd ordered.
This is why she was fired?
Yes.
What?
It was gross misconduct, and she was accused of stealing food.
She won how much money?
£3,000, almost $5,000, and they are going to give her a really good reference.
Okay, and she gets to put an extra scoop of coal in the boss's Christmas stocking, right?
Right.
Because that's justice.
Rico and Brendan do a radio show called The Dinner Party. There's a link to the podcast on our website, marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money.
Parents are giving substantial tips in wealthier areas to teachers.
A look at the tipping point. I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.